So some of you got here early and started early, and some people maybe saw the abstract, which said that we were going to do this exercise. So when it comes time to break into small groups, you will self-identify if you feel ready to start or if you want more time to do the exercise. So our plan for this 2 hours time block we have is actually general advice. What I'm mainly going to be doing is introducing you to the getting started exercise. And then we will count off how many people we have, how many small group leaders we have, and break you into small groups where you can work on the exercise. And we're going to allow an hour for the small group exercise. All right, so then we have time at the end to go through other kinds of advice, that things you need to know when you're writing your manuscripts. So some people love to write, and some people, you know, it's painful to write. So our job here is, even if you love to write, you want to write as many papers as you can, as quickly as you can, right, once you have your results. I have a huge backlog of papers. So how do we make it efficient to write? How do we make it as easy as possible to write? And I'd say most of the advice I'm going to have for you is about how to write only what you need and not spend a lot of time writing stuff that you're not going to be able to use. Because that happens, right? You've all had that experience. So in the general category of making sure that what you write is going to be as useful as possible, the first advice is to know who you're writing for. So, I should say by way of introduction, this topic, some of you have written books on this topic, right? How to write a manuscript. Mike Kelly taught a class. Where is Mike Kelly? which I adopted, so at various institutions, I'm sorry, and Eric Lichtfuss aussi teaches such a class. So when we take students through a whole semester of activities to get you to the point of finishing your paper to be ready to submit to the journal, one of the early exercises is going to be choosing your journal. So how many of you already know what journal you think you're writing your paper for? All right, and you should research a little bit. You can look at you're all familiar with examples of papers published in journals. You should read the instructions. You should download the instructions to authors from the journals you're considering as you decide what journal you're writing for. So obviously the choice of journal to write for would change the way you present your work. So if you know that, you're going to write for the right target audience. Knowing what the point of your paper is important. And that's primarily what we're going to be doing for you today in your getting started exercise. So if you know what the most important take-home messages are from your paper, you'll focus your paper on that. And there may be things you did that do not belong in your paper. Okay, and if you can figure that out before you start writing, then you won't write all about those and cut them out later. Okay, and one more tip for how not to write a lot of things you don't need is to use an outline. So, how many of you routinely write from an outline? I bet not most. Oh, wow, that's pretty good. I use an outline as a rescue tool, you know, like, oh man, this is not working. I better write an outline and see how I'm organizing myself, and then I can improve on it. It's more efficient to start with the outline and write what you need. So here we go, finding your main message. This is maybe different from most of what you've done in school, where an instructor would ask you a question and your job is to answer. So what you have now are some answers. I'm presuming, if this is not the case for you, pretend that it is. You have your results and you're ready to start writing. So if you don't have your results yet, we still want you to do the exercise. Make up some results and do the exercise. So you have answers and you need a question to match your answer. And this may not be something you've been asked to do very often, but it's key to focusing your paper. And it's hard if the question you started with is no longer the best question. right? So you write a proposal. Some of us have a lot of experience with this. You write a great proposal, really cool hypotheses. Your answers don't relate to what you thought you were going to get. The last thing you want to do is write a paper saying, I have this cool hypothesis and my answer doesn't relate to what I asked. Okay, so I'm going to take you through some examples of this, and these are modeled after your getting started exercise. So my examples come from my field, which is forest soils. And one of the topics that's interesting to forest soils people is all this nitrogen. If you clear cut a forest, you get a lot of nitrogen coming out. So what are the factors? This is a cool research question. What are the factors that explain high nitrogen mineralization after forest harvest? So we're going to measure moisture and temperature. People think it's because there's more moisture and higher temperature after you remove the forest. We'll measure the nitrogen mineralization rates. So this, if you were evaluating a proposal, you would say this is a good research question. Okay? But if we knew the answer before we started, this wouldn't be research, right? So it was true. This is a real story. This is from Frost Valley in the Catskills in New York, where the drinking water from New York City comes from. So they care a lot about nitrate in their drinking water. So you do a clear cut, you get a lot of nitrogen in the stream water. But mineralization rates were not higher in the clear cut. This is important. So the high nitrification that occurs after forest harvest is not because higher mineralization rates, it's because the trees aren't there to take up the nitrogen. It's a cool story. But my original question is not a good question to go with my answer, right? What explains high mineralization rates? I don't have high mineralization rates. I have the same mineralization rates I had before. I have less uptake. So what would be a good question to go with this answer? Anybody? Yes? Yeah, so I should focus my question on the nitrogen loss, because I do have a nitrogen loss, and I want to explain my nitrogen loss. Okay, so what factors explain high rates of nitrogen export after forest harvest? And I can be more explicit. I can ask, is it true that nitrogen mineralization rates are increased? I love alternate hypotheses. Or is increased nitrogen availability explained by the absence of tree uptake? Okay, so now I have a question that matches my answer. And this is what you're going to be doing when you write your getting started exercise. I have another example. Also, I'm sorry, from the forestry field. So we were interested in coarse woody debris, so what gets left behind after cutting a forest, and how does that depend on the silviculture treatment? So how much did we cut the forest? It should relate to the amount of wood that gets left behind. But there was not a relationship with silvicultural treatment, and I can tell you why. So if fuel costs increase, then it's worthwhile to remove that stuff and use it for firewood. This is also in the Catskills, and there had been a particle board factory that was a market for this material. So if the particle board factory closes, then more stuff gets left in the woods. This wasn't in our question. All right, and then, you know, this also depends on weather factors. So if my answer is not good in terms of silvicultural treatment, I need a new question. Somebody want to try this one? What would be a good question? Yeah, same thing. I can just back off a little bit and say what factors are important to predicting these things? Is harvest intensity sufficient? Yes or no? Okay, so this should look a little bit familiar to some of you who have looked at the Getting Started exercise. I suggest you start with number 3, which is your answer, right? Because you can't change your answer, but you can change your question. So first, you should write number three. And number two is the question that goes with your answer. So we're going to have you do this. Some of you have done it. Some of you will be starting in the small groups. And in the small groups, you're going to trade exercises, and you can help each other check, do I have a question that matches my answer? All right, so that's your task in the small groups, is to help each other with that. All right, and there's more to writing a paper than just your question and your answer. We need an introduction. We need to know who cares. Why is this important? So you're going to start with a big picture. You're going to focus in on your objectives and your question. You're going to tell us the answer in your paper and in your getting started exercise. And then at the end, we want to know, what did we get? How does this relate back to the big question that we asked at the beginning? So the next thing I'll do in this example is we're going to look at how we choose the context, how we choose that big picture question, and how do we choose conclusions that relate back to that. So going back to my first example where we were looking at nitrogen in stream water and mineralization rates. So here's a problem statement. We had an opportunity to measure gross and net nitrogen mineralization and nitrification because we have this clear cut. That's not very compelling, right? So we have an opportunity because we're doing a clear cut, so we're going to measure something. No, why do people care about this problem? So there's a drinking water issue. There's also, because we found something different from what people thought, everybody said, disturbance increases decomposition and mineralization. If that's not true, I should focus my question on that, my problem statement on that. So the belief that decomposition and nutrient mineralization increase following disturbance pervades calculations of local and global carbon and nitrogen budgets, but this belief is not based on direct observation. So then I can focus in and say, we're going to test this. My question is, what factors explain? Okay, so actually, let me say this to you. When you read each other's problem statements, the common thing is they're going to be not general enough because we're focused in on our little, you know, fields of specialization, and you can ask each other, why do we measure that, or why is that important? And then the most common problem with number four is that it's going to be a repetition of the results. So it's true that nitrate losses increase after harvesting, but this is not due to increased nitrogen mineralization. You should say, that sounds like a result. And I'll tell you, this happens over and over again, and you'll see it, and you can help each other. Sometimes the results in number four, or in people's discussion sections, are really good. They're even better than what they wrote in the results section. So use it, you know, just move it up into the other section. So I'm going to do that here. I'm going to improve my number three. High nitrification results from the lack of uptake by trees, not from higher gross mineralization rates. And then how do I get back out to my big problem? Look back up at number one and see what you can say about that. Ecosystem nitrogen budgets should not assume that mineralization increases after disturbance. Carbon budgets, too, may be in error if decomposition is assumed to increase after forest harvest. There were global carbon budgets that said, oh, half of the carbon in the mineral soil is lost after forest harvest. Not true. Okay, so briefly, the other example, of course, we did a debris study. Oh, this is a common form of a problem statement that's not very compelling. This has not been measured before. It doesn't say. Ron is yawning, right? So it doesn't say why would we measure it, just because it's never been measured before. So, actually, something you find like that might be good for an objective statement. So you could help somebody move that down into their question and say, why do we care? Well, we care a lot about the amount of coarse woody debris because it affects things like, well, carbon sequestration, right? Or wildlife habitat. There's non-timber values that we care about, and we need to know if we can predict them. And then number four, course-weighted revolume is not readily predicted. That is what we found. This is a more disappointing study than the first one. And I can move that into results, I think. That's a result. So if I want to get back up to, it's not readily predicted, but what am I going to tell them? What's my advice to the audience who cares? I'm going to say, you better measure it. You better measure it if it's not very predictable. But we do have data saying that the nutrient contents are pretty predictable, so we can give advice to practitioners. One of the things to think of when you're thinking about things to put in number four, are there management implications? Who needs to know? How do I get it back out to the audience who cares? Okay, do you feel ready to do this?
Hey,
yes.
Can I make a comment on that last one you had up there?
Yes.
If you had number three, for example, volumes of course would degree depend on cutting intensity, but also on markets and for wood product. If you haven't studied markets, is that still a result for your study?
Yeah, that would be an interpretation. And, you know, I'm going to say, so I don't think I said this. When you have finished your exercise, you pretty much have an abstract, right? You have a problem statement, you have objectives, you have your results, and you have conclusions. And one thing that we don't spend time on in this exercise is discussion, really. We'll come to that later, after you do your getting started exercise. So Ron is asking, is this really results, or is this interpretation or discussion? So you'll deal with that. Yeah. We know when the particle board factory closed, but we don't have a controlled experiment. Okay, so here's what you're going to do. You know how to help each other. You're going to compare number three and number two to see if the results in number three are have the best relationship possible to the question in number two. Which one can you change if they don't match up? Change a question. Okay, number one, you can help people see if they can make that more general. You'll capture a bigger audience if you can say why it's important. I predict you're going to find some results in number four, so you can help identify those, move them back to number three, such that number four gets us back to the big picture question. And then you're going to help each other just by saying, oh, I don't understand what you mean here. Can you explain it to me? And that'll help them figure out how to write it better. Okay, so these are the tasks for the small groups. I'm going to put the questions up again so you have them. You're going to start with number three. That's what you know the best, and you can't change it, what your results are. number two, the question. And then number one and number four, tackle last. I think the instructions say we're going to give you just 10 minutes to do this, and then we're going to proceed with reading each other's and sharing, and your small group facilitators will help you. We have some really great small group facilitators. They've all written papers. They've written books. Some of them have written books about how to write papers. They have served as editors of journals, so you can ask them any questions you like as you go through this process. And John is going to count for me how many facilitators do we have? Okay. So I'm not going to have you count off by nine yet, because first I'm going to ask how many people feel confident they have an exercise and they're ready to trade it. How many of those are there, John? And we need how many people and how many groups there are. Did you already count the people in the room?
No, I did not.
Nine. Okay, I can do it better than you can because I can see better, right? Do you know? I think we have close to 80, including the facilitators. So how many? Nine divided by, so seven, eight people per group? That's nice. It's perfect. All right, so raise your hand again if you want to start now, and we'll see if we think there's 8 of you or 16 of you. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. We'll have you move to the front, the speedy groups. 9 altogether, and the rest should count off by 7s. Okay. And then we're going to move chairs and divide you up and get you started. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. I think that's 2 groups. So what did we say? There's 9 groups altogether, so we count off by 7s. You have to remember your number. Okay, so here in the front, or can you say 1? 1. All right. 2. 2. Okay, I'm sorry to break it up, but it's time to turn your chairs to the front. If you want to keep working with your small group pairs, make an appointment for later in the day. Was the peer review process helpful? You can exchange email addresses and cell phone numbers. Oh, I want a round of applause for our facilitators, our small group facilitators, because I know some of them are going to be rushing off to other sessions. And they are really what make this workshop so effective. So thank you very much to our small group facilitators. Hey, Josh, when you get wonderful comments, you all guys are all going to fill out, like, feedback forms or something, right? Oh, we're supposed to have forms? Yeah, and then send me some of the nice things they say about their small groups, and I'll pass them on to the facilitators. Thank you. So we have almost 40 minutes left. I'm going to run through some other advice that might help you in your preparation of manuscripts. And then hopefully I'll have a little time for questions and answers, and there's lots of people in the room who can help you with answers as well as I can. So you can probably guess which section of your manuscript I suggest you focus on first. Results. All right, so you need to be clear about your results. Getting started exercise is going to help you even know which results belong in your paper. Some of your results don't belong in your paper. Once you know exactly which results belong in your paper, that is probably the easiest section to write. Actually, yes?
Yeah, I'd like to make a suggestion there.
Ma'am? Yeah.
Yeah, I think when you're putting together your results, rather than trying to start out with a narrative statement, start out with your graph.
Oh, we're going to get to that.
Okay.
Next slide. Okay, methods is really easy to write, but I want you to do it after your results because you don't want to go off writing methods for things that don't end up in your results section. That's the reason that comes second. Okay, there was some discussion in one back group in the corner about the difficulty of the discussion and the conclusions. I think the introduction and discussion are more difficult to write, they're less formulaic, right? What are you going to put in there? But you have good ideas now because you've thought about what the big picture question is, and your conclusions are going to come out and match that. I think Mike recommends introduction before discussion. Doug Sprugel told me the discussion is easier for them. You know what you have to do in the discussion better than in the results, in the introduction, or write them simultaneously because you're going to be making decisions about which type of background information, reference to other studies, belongs where. So it's like you're getting started. Methods and results need to be written in good relationship to one another, and your introduction and your discussion need to be written in good relation to one another.
Have a flexible mind in all of that.
Have a flexible mind. And a long pencil. So, you probably have a title and abstract already. In fact, you have an abstract. You have an abstract today, right? But after you've written your paper, you're going to go back to your title and abstract. Those are the most important parts of your paper per word. That's what people are going to see, and that's how they're going to decide whether to read your paper. Okay, so, yes? I'm sorry, yeah. So some journals will have a separate conclusion section. You will have read the instructions. You will know exactly what sections your journal requires. All right, and many do not identify a summary. Some will have a summary section, a conclusion section. Some have implications for management sections. You will write exactly the sections that they expect from you. All right, and your conclusions would likely be in your discussion section if your journal doesn't specify another section. Thank you for asking that. Yes?
One of the things that I have found with beginning writers is sometimes it is actually, even though your journal may ask you for a separate result, a combined results and discussion section, it is often to your advantage to write them separately first and then mesh them, as opposed to trying to write them as a mesh session at the beginning.
Yeah, I agree. Writing, I have sometimes done it, but rarely, and I think it takes more skill to do a good combined results and discussion section, and it's easy to get lost or undisciplined or something if you do them separately. Okay, so Ron said the best way to start thinking about your results is to prepare your figures and tables. Melissa Lukash put this together for me. She has examples. How do you decide whether you're going to present information as a table, a figure, or text? When I do this for a whole semester, we prepare tables and figures really early on and share them for peer review. So you can start a support group for writing your papers and share things for peer review. So this was an example of, it doesn't even say what it is. It's photosynthesis measurements. All right, so do you like the figure or the table? Why? We can see a pattern. Why would you ever use a table? We can always see patterns better in figures. Well, let me show you another example. She took this out of one of my manuscripts, nutrient contents of vegetation. I'll give you a hint. This is Watershed 5 at Hubbard Brook. Actually, that's not a great figure. I would have done stacked bars, maybe, for biomass. In this paper, it was a table. And the reason is that people are going to want those numbers when they do their budgets, okay? So if somebody wants your exact number, you don't want them sending you an email every time they want to know what the mean was or eyeballing it or what would you... There's probably software tools now that you could measure the height of a bar in their figure. But if you know people want the value, then you would put it in a table. And the journal will tell you, when you read the instructions, that you can't duplicate your information. You're not going to publish both. So you have to choose. They will also tell you, or I will tell you, not to repeat information in the figure, table, and text. So this is also a forestry whole tree harvesting experiment. Anybody want to vote for the figure, the table, or the text? Okay, so it's only three numbers, right? Text. Text seems adequate. Unless somebody needs the number. Well, if they need the number, it's in the text. Okay, so as you write your results, you will have your tables and figures in front of you. You have your getting started exercise, so you know what your question was, and you can describe your results as the answer to your question. You need to make sure the readers get what you want them to out of your figures and tables, right? So, but you don't want to repeat the figures and tables in your text. So you get the distinction. Should I try to do an example?
Right there, I think you had a good example in the next slide. Yeah, let's pretend that you have more data than what.
Yes. Okay, so if the figure were in your table, if the figure were in your publication, it would be legitimate in your text to tell us numbers that we should see and to tell us which is highest, which is lowest, which is intermediate, right? But you're not going to, yeah.
And then give a parenthetical reference in your text to figure one or table within.
Yes. Oh, yeah. And you can reference if you don't reference the table, the journal is going to say is going to complain. You can reference it more than once. So you reference it every time, including in your discussion, when the reader is going to be helped by knowing what you're referring to.
Ruth, maybe I'm doing a lot of talking here, but I'd like to keep this point going you had up there.
Yeah.
Can you back that up? Notice that text. Notice what that text does not do. That text does not say, the results are shown in figure one.
Oh.
it gives you a definite statement. And then lead you to figure one.
Thank you, Ron. Waste of a sentence. The results are shown in table one. Tell us what it is we're supposed to get out of table one.
And that's a very good way to lead
yeah.
the narrative of your results.
So are you saying that text you wouldn't have in your results section is text if you had the table? Or what were you saying?
I'm saying that if you read the text, the harvest removal ratio was highest, et cetera. That's a nice narrative statement to begin your results section. It does not say the results are shown in figure one.
Oh, I understand that part. I was actually asking about.
Yeah, I think the table and the text are redundant. So I wouldn't include that table. Well, it's only got three numbers in it. If I had a lot more data, I would say the ratios in general were highest for P, and I wouldn't put the numbers in there because the numbers are in the table. So that's you have to figure out how to make sure that your table and your text are adding value and they're not doing the exact same thing. Okay. I mentioned that your methods needs to be related to your results, so it's not going to include things you did that don't. You think this is dumb, but don't write everything you ever did, right? It's only going to be the things that relate to what your results say. And there's two criteria for what you need to report. How much do you need to say? You need to say enough. This is an important part of like the scientific enterprise. Someone else could repeat your study as a test. Somebody else is going to be interested in your study. Say, oh, I could do that in my system. So what would somebody else need to know if they were going to repeat your study? That's one criterion. And the other is, what fraction of the readers of your paper are actually going to repeat your study? Not very many. Your most important audience is readers who want to understand your study. So the other criterion is the readers need to know enough to understand what you did. And don't tell us stuff that's not needed either to understand, you know, for the reader or for the scientist wanting to replicate your study. So I'm going to give you some examples. And you tell me if this is too much information, too little information, or just right. Samples were digested in nitric acid. No, what? Too little. What else do we need? Yeah, concentration of nitric acid. So not enough information. How about this? Oh, here's a good one. Plots were marked with orange flagging at the north. they're all laughing. I got this from a student paper, not from a manuscript. But I do see things in manuscripts sometimes that we didn't need to know. Do we need to know that they were marked at all? Never mind what color flagging it was. Okay, this one's more controversial. Procedures followed Bickelhaupt. Is that enough? It's enough for the scientist who wants to. Is the reader going to be satisfied with that? No. Okay, so in that case, you've met the one criteria but not the other. What did you do? So include a little bit. Even if you're giving a reference where somebody really motivated can go read, you don't look up every reference in every paper you read, so make sure that it's going to be readable to someone who's not running to the library. Okay, so next I'm talking about the discussion section. What do you need to be able to do in your discussion section? Yes. So if your journal, in your journals, there can be a supplemental section. They go to a website or something. Yes. Yeah, that's nice. So then you would base your criterion for what stays in the paper as what the casual reader or what you think your your modal reader wants to know. That's a very nice solution, and that's easy now, right? Because there's you could put plenty of information in an electronic resource.
The extra figures also, which may not be the key figures for the results, but which may help them for the...
Yeah, things are changing, so we don't have to be quite so selective about what we publish. Okay, discussion section. Interpretation of your results, obviously. And then, some of this, I argue that we should know the meaning of your results when we read your results section. If you've answered your question, we should know what the answer is. But there's a lot more that you might need to explain. Unexpected results, what are you going to say about those? You don't want to start messing up your results section by going into that. So discussion, you're going to discuss your results. You need to place your results in the context of other work. And this is where we get some art as we look also at your introduction, because your introduction is going to be looking at other work and making your question in the context of other work. I have a template. Eric mentioned he has templates for students going through these processes, so I made it for my students, but now when I start a paper, I bring up my template. It has headings, in Word, in the hierarchical word structure, so you can navigate with the navigation pane. And one of the topics in the discussion section is address limitations to your approach. So commonly, you might need to think about that. Suggest future work. So in the original Getting Started exercise that I got from Mike Kelly, the fifth question was, tell us a question that could be asked now that couldn't be asked before. And we simplified and took that out, but I think that's a great thing to think about when you're writing your discussion section. Yes?
If we have several parts in our experiment, for example, we have several different results, should we put the discussion after in each section, in each result? For example, this is my result, this is the discussion, result, the second result,
Yeah, so we just said we advise that you keep your results and your discussion separate. You could use subheadings, and they could be parallel. It's very satisfying. One thing, so when you give a talk, you can say, it's much easier for the audience to follow, we did this and we got this answer, and here's what, we think about it. So then we did this and we got this answer. I have never seen, well, I have written something like this. Most scientific journals are not going to let you have five different methods sections followed by your five different results and your five different discussions. They will let you sometimes combine your results and discussion. The simplest thing to do is to have five subheadings in your methods section, and five subheadings in your results section, and five subheadings in your discussion section. Whether you want to recombine that, you'll figure it out. Some of you are going to face this problem. Okay, conclusions you were talking about today. So if this may be part of a separate section, it may be part of your discussion section. Applications, who's gonna use this? This gets back up to your big question number one, to whom does this matter? So you're gonna hopefully in your end of your paper get back up to those big questions that you started with. John, are you gonna say something? Okay, so as you write your introduction, it'll match up with your conclusions. So that big problem, you've all been spending time now thinking about your big problem to be solved. How broad, how big can you make your funnel that's going to catch people's interest and bring them into your specific problem? Review the relevant literature. So again, you have to be careful this isn't too redundant with what you need to say in your discussion when you relate your work to similar studies. And it's important to say to students who are writing theses that this is not your committee, and they do not need to know everything that you read, right? Your committee needs to know that, and if you have a manuscript format thesis, you probably have to have an introduction where you have a giant lit review. This is not your giant lit review. This is the audience of people. Just all they need to know is enough to funnel into your study. So you need to know all that other stuff, but your journal audience doesn't need to know that you know all that other stuff. Yes?
This might be a silly question, but as far as the literature
Oh, who has an opinion about this? Is she old and irrelevant if she cites a 10-year-old paper? Is that your question? There's some important papers out there. Yeah. Yes. One way to minimize the number of papers that you cite, if you can find something recent that describes the previous work, that's efficient. My rule is that you never want to give more than 3 citations for any point, so be selective, and your people are not going to go read 5 papers if you list 5 of them. So it has to be selective. Okay, and then normally, unless your journal says it's a separate section, the last thing in your introduction is your objectives. So you study some papers. We do this in class. Study papers and look at what each of the paragraphs is doing in the introduction. Do that for the discussion, too. Those are the hard ones to organize. I think you'll find that usually the last paragraph of the introduction is going to be the objective. Yes, people are nodding. You've already noticed that. Okay, so we said you're going to be done with your paper by the time you write your abstract, but some of this you've already done, and these parts should look familiar from your getting started exercise. So you're going to start with a problem statement. I've seen a lot of abstracts that don't. They say, we'd measured this thing. Well, why? Make sure you start with something compelling about the problem. The objectives. Very often the methods are not mentioned in an abstract, so it depends whether it's completely straightforward and your audience knows exactly what methods you would have used. Results, you did that. You're good, but make sure you review them after you've written your paper. Okay, and conclusions, there may be discussion in there too. Make sure you read the directions and know what your word limit is on your abstract before you write it. Any questions on abstracts? Yes.
What about the general proportions of each component in the abstract? So what would you suggest for the proportion of, if you have a word limit of 300 words, would you want most of it to be the results?
Yeah, I'd say you can do your problem in one sentence. 2 is a lot for an abstract. And your objectives probably is one sentence. In the abstract, nobody's going to complain if you sequence things. You know, if you say, we did this and found this, then we tried this, because of that, we've tried this and found this, that's going to work in an abstract, and they won't let you do that in the paper. So you don't want to say, we did the following 5 methods, and then we got the following 5 results in your abstract. That's just hard to read. Oh, title. So I said the most important, yes.
And a more general question. If you introduce something that you're going to be abbreviating or referencing in a different way in the abstract, do you then do that again in the introduction or the first time it comes up in the body of the paper?
Oh, do we have any editors in the room still? Yes.
In general, yes. If you're talking about abbreviations, defining the end of the body.
Thank you.
Remember about abstracts is they need to stand alone. Because they are often abstracted services separate the abstract from the paper. So if you've got a lot of abbreviations in the paper, they won't be there in the abstract.
I generally recommend, unless there are cases where it's very clear you have to abbreviate something, you can say it like 20 times, or it's a very long compound name or something like that. But in general, things you normally abbreviate in the body, if you're only going to use them a couple times or they're a short word, I wouldn't abbreviate in the abstract. Abbreviations tend to be very distracting, especially if they're not commonly associated abbreviations. Everyone knows the N's and PRs, so you abbreviate that, but an abbreviation that's unique to your paper, probably in the abstract, is distracting.
One journal, I don't remember which one, would cut out any acronyms that weren't used more than twice in the paper. Well, that seems like a good rule. And if they're not used more than twice in the abstract, apply the rule there, too. If you're going to use it 10 times in the paper but once in the abstract, don't ask people to learn a new term.
Even in the body of the paper, people tend to over-abbreviate, and they are distracting, so only when absolutely necessary.
We said that your abstract's important because people are going to read that and decide whether to read your paper. You've done this a million times. You don't even look at the abstract unless you think the title is what you are looking for, right? So title is the most important part of your paper per unit word. You need to think about what people are going to be searching for when they find your paper. So keywords, you're going to be able to provide keywords, and the words in your title function as keywords as well. Some journals will give you a word limit, a suggested word limit for your title. And I think this society is the one that says 12. Am I right? Aim for 12. So I have an example. You can give me your peer review comments on this title. A student did a study on the effect of mycorrhizal association on seedling uptake of nitrate versus ammonium. What do you want to know besides that?
What seedling is
for? What species are we talking about? Is that what you meant? Okay, so now we have, it's a eucalypt species. Effect of mycorrhizal association on nitrogen uptake by Eucalyptus canadulensis. Anybody have another request or a better suggestion? Yeah, I don't know what it is. Yeah.
Is it okay to use like the effect?
Yeah, so the effect of is kind of a waste. Is that what you meant?
Yeah.
Three words? What did that give me? How about could we like say the answer? What was the answer? Mycorrhizal association improves nitrate but not ammonium uptake. Okay. And how many words is it?
11.
So that's an exercise you can do. Oh, I'll tell you this. In my class, at the end of the semester, when they do their abstracts, I don't tell them this. If they bring it to class with the title on, I cut it off with scissors. And in the process of reviewing the abstracts, they each have to write a title for the one they're reviewing. And the authors are often surprised. So you can try that. Try writing a title for your friend. And if something important doesn't show up in the title, it could be because your abstract didn't have it in there and you expected it. Ron.
I'd like to make two comments here, please. Notice in those first two, look at the number of prepositional phrases. Cut out prepositional phrases, or I shouldn't say don't eliminate them completely, but minimize them. And in the last one, number three, there's still a redundancy in there. I would say that mycorrhizae are an association. So mycorrhizal association is a bit redundant.
Oh,
simply say mycorrhizae
improve. He's right. The sentence structure is much more direct in that last title. One group was asking about indirect sentence construction, passive voice, and that's something you want to strive to have the most direct, clear language possible, and get your message across as simply as possible. Yes?
So are you curious about the opinion of the room? My advisor is really into sort of
colon, yeah.
Colon,
some read the instructions, because some of the instructions to authors say they discourage those.
Yeah.
So if you don't like it and your journal has instructions against it, you can show that. I've done them. Any comments from editors in the room, authors in the room? Yeah.
I like the third one because it conveys the progress. The two first ones are informative, they are good, but the third one gives an idea of the novelty versus current knowledge, and that's the part of the scientific paper.
What did this paper contribute that's new? Is that we want our titles to convey that? Is that your point? What is your paper contributing? You should feel good about writing papers. I'm proud of you all. You're all going to write papers. Okay, you're going to prepare a literature cited section. I just heard a long, funny story about these. Read the instructions, okay? Otherwise, the reviewer gets it and says, well, one of two things. Ah, I recognize this format. This paper was rejected from a different journal. Or, you know, if they're all inconsistent, then we wonder, is this person a good scientist if they can't pay attention to following pattern on their literature cited format. And then it's easy to now to not make mistakes. How many of you are already using some kind of journal? You're using EndNote or RefWorks or ProCite or one of those things. Okay, so then if you get rejected from a journal and you need to reformat for another journal, it's one click, right? Instead of painfully going through there and removing all the periods and resorting the, yeah. Yes, question.
I've used EndNote before, and for the Soil Science Society of America journal, it actually doesn't abbreviate. It doesn't do it correctly for you, according to what the requirements are. So you have to be careful about using Tumblr, because sometimes you'll do most of everything correct for you.
Oh, even though you selected that particular journal as your formatting style? All right, so check it, even if you think it's following the instructions for you. Thank you for that comment. Oh, so, and what should you do if you get rejected? Okay, so those are the end of my prepared comments. You can download this presentation from my website. It's in the abstract for the program. The exercises that I use in my class are all there. So we have almost 10 minutes left for other questions. Oh, and we have the
surveys are moving forward.
Okay, so
I'm not letting anyone out the door.
The early career members committee would appreciate your comments on the workshop, and I'll ask them to pass on any advice that you have back to us again. So other questions about the writing process, the publication process, the editorial review process? Yes.
I have problems in the results when you have to talk about statistics.
Yes.
So should you start with talking about the practical, let's say about higher nitrogen and less this, and then they were statistically different and something like that?
Who did I just have this conversation with, Mike? I'm so glad you asked this, because this is one of the things I address over and over again, not only with my students, but in the manuscripts I review. I know that it's hard work to do all those statistics, and I think that may be why there's way too much focus on the statistics in some of the manuscripts that we see. What the reviewer wants to know is what happened in your system of study, right? So the subject of the sentence should be something like corn or soil, or for me it would be the tree. It wouldn't be the ANOVA blah, 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 blah. It would be, what was it? The nitrogen was more than the phosphorus, and then you would say by a bivariate multi-blah statistic and give us a FP whatever value, right? So those should be kind of like parenthetical comments, and if you can, you want simple, direct sentences that have the subject being your subject, and your subject is not the statistical analysis, right? But you see how people get there. By the time they finish their statistical analysis, in their mind, it's the subject. Thank you for bringing that one up. Yes. Oh, because it's a difficult one? Yeah, you know, I have written titles that said things like challenges in measuring. So if you want to convey that that it's a problematic topic, you could say that. Some titles just say coarse woody debris in northern hardwood forests under different silvicultural treatment, and then we don't know what the answer was, but neither did the author. You should write a bunch of titles. In the getting started exercise, I simplified it and took this out. But one of the parts said, write it two different ways. And when I paint, I sometimes do two canvases because I'm a little more, I'll take a risk and try something. All right, so write five. Write five possible titles for your paper. And maybe when you get to the fifth one, you'll have a breakthrough. Yes. It's easier to write somebody else's title than your own title.
Yeah, exactly.
It is. Yes, here.
So my research is about weed resistance and four sections in my research, and what would you recommend? Do I have to put all the, does every section have to show in the title?
Oh, right, no, so you probably can't. I mean, if you have a 12-word goal, there's no way. I'm going to suggest something else, and this may not pertain to you, but this is something I do all the time. It's not always easy to decide what's one paper, more papers. You have a social survey as well as a treatment thing. You know, maybe it's more than one paper. And I use the getting started exercise. So if I have a big paper, I'm trying to decide if it's two separate papers, that's three getting started exercises, okay? The one for what if it were all together, and the one for what if it were two separately. It's easy compared to writing the thing three different ways, right? So then I look at them, oh yeah, this one would be pretty good, but this one would not be publishable. I think I'm gonna write it all together in one. Or you say, oh, this one's much better by itself than it was with that other stuff in it. You know, I need another measurement or something. So I think if you can getting started exercise is a way to try it without wasting a lot of effort. How am I gonna put these things together?
Let me partially respond with this question. I think at the beginning of this, Dr. Yan and I was talking about selecting the journal. So one of the things you have to have really clear in mind is what audience are you trying to reach with this particular piece of writing that you do. Most of us write for the peer community. We write for other researchers. And we publish in journals that other researchers read. Now, if you're writing things that are intended for practicing agronomists, that's going to be in a whole separate set of journals, most likely. So you're going to write your paper in such a way that it will be of use to the audience that you're trying to reach. So sometimes you write a paper for the research community and then follow it up with an extension community or something like that. So it depends on what you're trying to do.
At this point in your career, you're trying to maximize your number of publications, right? So that's a nice suggestion. If you can get two papers out of it because they're directed to different audiences, you still want to make sure they're not, you know, they have to be distinct enough to be separately publishable. You're going to sign something when you submit your paper telling the journal that this material has not been published elsewhere. But if you can get two nice packages out of it, that's better than one at this stage of your career. Yes? That's a lot of words already. No, I think I've only seen suggested lengths. You'll read the instructions. Most of them don't mention the length of the title. The instructions to reviewers may say, will often has a question about the title, because the title's so important. So write your best title and you might get review comments on it if it's really long. Yes. Okay, thank you very much. Make sure you hand it your feedback form when you leave the room.
Also,